Chapter 53. Her journey back was rather a meander than a march. It had no sprightliness, no purpose, only a tendency. Along the tedious length of Benville Lane she began to grow tired, and she leant upon gates and paused by milestones. She did not enter any house till, at the seventh or eighth mile, she descended the steep long hill below which lay the villager townlet of Evershead, where in the morning as he had breakfasted with such contrasting expectations. The cottage by the church, in which he again sat down, was almost the first at that end of the village, and while the woman fetched her some milk from the pantry, Tess, looking down the street, perceived that the place seemed quite deserted. "The people are gone to afternoon service, I suppose," she said. "No, my dear," said the old woman. "'Tis too soon for that. The bells ain't struck out yet. They be all gone to hear the preaching in yonder barn. A ranter preaches there between the services, an excellent, fiery, Christian man, they say. But, Lord, I don't go to hear'n. What comes in the regular way over the pulpit is hot enough for I." Tess soon went onward into the village, her footsteps echoing against the houses, as though it were a place of the dead. Nearing the central part, her echoes were intruded on by other sounds, and seeing the barn not far off the road, she guessed these to be the utterances of the preacher. His voice became so distinct in the still clear air that she could soon catch his sentences, though she was on the close side of the barn. The sermon, as might be expected, was of the extremest antinomian type, on justification by faith, as expounded in the theology of St. Paul. This fixed idea of the rhapsodist was delivered with animated enthusiasm, in a manner entirely declamatory, for he had plainly no skill as a dialectician. Although Tess had not heard the beginning of the address, she learned what the text had been from its constant iteration, "O foolish Galatians, who hath bewitched you, that ye should not obey the truth, before whose eyes Jesus Christ hath been evidently set forth, crucified among you?" Tess was all the more interested, as she stood listening behind, in finding that the preacher's doctrine was a vehement form of the view of Angel's Father, and her interest intensified, when the speaker began to detail his own spiritual experiences, of how he had come by those views. He had, he said, been the greatest of sinners. He had scoffed, he had wantonly associated with the reckless and the lewd. But a day of awakening had come, and, in a human sense, it had been brought about mainly by the influence of a certain clergyman, whom he had at first grossly insulted, but whose parting words had sunk into his heart, and had remained there, till by the grace of heaven they had worked this change in him, and made him what they saw him. But more startling to Tess than the doctrine had been the voice, which, impossible as it seemed, was precisely that of Alec D'Urberville. Her face fixed in painful suspense, she came round to the front of the barn, and passed before it. The low winter sun beamed directly upon the great double-doored entrance on this side, one of the doors being open, so that the rays stretched far in over the threshing floor to the preacher and his audience, all snugly sheltered from the northern breeze. The listeners were entirely villagers, among them being the man whom as he had seen carrying the red paint pot on a former memorable occasion. But her attention was given to the central figure, who stood upon some sacks of corn, facing the people and the door. The 3 o'clock sun shone full upon him, and the strange enervating conviction that her seducer confronted her, which had been gaining ground in Tess ever since as he had heard his words distinctly, was at last established as a fact indeed. End of phase the fifth. Phase the sixth. The convert, XLV, till this moment as he had never seen or heard from D'Urberville since her departure from Trantridge. The rencounter came at a heavy moment, one of all moments calculated to permit its impact with the least emotional shock. But such was unreasoning memory that, though he stood there openly and palpably a converted man, who was sorrowing for his past irregularities, a fear overcame her, paralyzing her movement, so that she neither retreated nor advanced. to think of what emanated from that countenance, when she saw it last, and to behold it now. There was the same handsome unpleasantness of mien, but now he wore neatly trimmed, old-fashioned whiskers, the sable mustache having disappeared, and his dress was half-clerical, a modification which had changed his expression sufficiently to abstract the dandyism from his features, and to hinder for a second her belief in his identity. To Tessa's sense there was, just at first, a ghastly bizarrery, a grim incongruity, in the march of these solemn words of scripture out of such a mouth. This too familiar intonation, less than 4 years earlier, had brought to her ears expressions of such divergent purpose, that her heart became quite sick at the irony of the contrast. It was less a reform than a transfiguration. The former curves of sensuousness were now modulated to lines of devotional passion. The lip shapes that had meant seductiveness were now made to express supplication. The glow on the cheek, that yesterday could be translated as riotousness, was evangelized today into the splendor of pious rhetoric. Animalism had become fanaticism, paganism Paulinism. The bold rolling eye that had flashed upon her form in the old time with such mastery now beamed with the rude energy of a theatre that was almost ferocious. Those black angularities which his face had used to put on when his wishes were thwarted now did duty in picturing the incorrigible backslider who would insist upon turning again to his wallowing in the mire. The lineaments, as such, seemed to complain. They had been diverted from their hereditary connotation, to signify impressions for which nature did not intend them. Strange that their very elevation was a misapplication, that to raise seemed to falsify. Yet could it be so? She would admit the ungenerous sentiment no longer. D'Urberville was not the first wicked man who had turned away from his wickedness, to save his soul alive, and why should she deem it unnatural in him? It was but the usage of thought which had been jarred in her at hearing good new words and bad old notes. The greater the sinner, the greater the saint. It was not necessary to dive far into Christian history to discover that. Such impressions as these moved her vaguely, and without strict definiteness. As soon as the nerveless pause of her surprise would allow her to stir, her impulse was to pass on out of his sight. He had obviously not discerned her yet in her position against the sun. But the moment that she moved again he recognized her. The effect upon her old lover was electric, far stronger than the effect of his presence upon her. His fire, the tumultuous ring of his eloquence, seemed to go out of him. His lips struggled and trembled under the words that lay upon it, but deliver them, it could not as long as she faced him. His eyes, after their first glance upon her face, hung confusedly in every other direction but hers, but came back in a desperate leap every few seconds. This paralysis lasted, however, but a short time, for Tessa's energies returned with the atrophy of his, and she walked as fast as she was able past the barn and onward. As soon as she could reflect it appalled her, this change in their relative platforms. He who had wrought her undoing was now on the side of the spirit, while she remained unregenerate. And, as in the legend, it had resulted that her Cyprian image had suddenly appeared upon his altar, whereby the fire of the priest had been well nigh extinguished. She went on without turning her head. Her back seemed to be endowed with a sensitiveness to ocular beams, even her clothing so alive was she to a fancied gaze which might be resting upon her from the outside of that barn. All the way along to this point her heart had been heavy with an inactive sorrow. Now there was a change in the quality of its trouble. That hunger for affection too long withheld was for the time displaced by an almost physical sense of an implacable past which still engirdled her. It intensified her consciousness of error to a practical despair, the break of continuity between her earlier and present existence, which as he had hoped for, had not, after all, taken place. Bygones would never be complete bygones till she was a bygone herself. Thus absorbed, she recrossed the northern part of Long Ash Lane at right angles, and presently saw before her the road ascending whitely to the upland along whose margin the remainder of her journey lay. Its dry, pale surface stretched severely onward, unbroken by a single figure, vehicle, or mark, save some occasional brown horse droppings which dotted its cold aridity here and there. While slowly breasting this ascent, Tess became conscious of footsteps behind her, and turning she saw approaching, that well-known form so strangely accoutred as the Methodist, the one personage in all the world she wished not to encounter alone on this side of the grave. There was not much time, however, for thought or illusion, and she yielded as calmly as she could to the necessity of letting him overtake her. She saw that he was excited, less by the speed of his walk than by the feelings within him. "Tess," he said. She slackened speed without looking round. "Tess," he repeated. "T is I Alec d'Urberville." She then looked back at him, and he came up. "I see it is," she answered coldly. "Well, is that all? Yet I deserve no more. Of course," he added, with a slight laugh, "there is something of the ridiculous to your eyes in seeing me like this. But I must put up with that. I heard you had gone away, nobody knew where. Tess, you wonder why I have followed you? I do, rather, and I would that you had not, with all my heart." "Yes, you may well say it," he returned grimly, as they moved onward together, she with unwilling tread. "But don't mistake me, I beg this, because you may have been led to do so in noticing, if you did notice it, how your sudden appearance unnerved me down there. It was but a momentary faltering, and considering what you have been to me, it was natural enough. But will help me through it, though perhaps you think me a humbug for saying it," and immediately afterwards I felt that of all persons in the world whom it was my duty and desire to save from the wrath to come near, if you like, the woman whom I had so grievously wronged was that person. I have come with that sole purpose in view, nothing more." There was the smallest vein of scorn in her words of rejoinder: "Have you saved yourself? Charity begins at home, they say." "I have done nothing," said he indifferently. "Heaven, as I have been telling my hearers, has done all. No amount of contempt that you can pour upon me, Tess, will equal what I have poured upon myself, the old Adam of my former years. Well, it is a strange story, believe it or not, but I can tell you the means by which my conversion was brought about, and I hope you will be interested enough at least to listen. Have you ever heard the name of the parson of Emminster? You must have done, do, old Mr. Clare, one of the most earnest of his school, one of the few intense men left in the church, not so intense as the extreme wind of Christian believers with which I have thrown in my lot, but quite an exception among the established clergy, the younger of whom are gradually attenuating the true doctrines by their sophistries, till they are but the shadow of what they were. I only differ from him on the question of church and state, the interpretation of the text, 'Come out from among them, and be ye separate, saith the Lord,' that's all. He is one who, I firmly believe, has been the humble means of saving more souls in this country than any other man you can name. You have heard of him?" "I have," she said. "He came to Trantridge 2 or 3 years ago to preach on behalf of some missionary society, and I, wretched fellow that I was, insulted him when, in his disinterestedness, he tried to reason with me and show me the way. He did not resent my conduct, he simply said that someday I should receive the first fruits of the Spirit, that those who came to scoff sometimes remained to pray. There was a strange magic in his." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.